Blog Talk Radio.
Book show, and this election, it's getting crazier and crazier every single day. So I thought we'd do a little summary of it. It obviously is not over, though sometimes it seems like it's over, or it certainly I would like it to be over, but it seems like we need kind of to step back and let's evaluate, where are we? What do we think of the candidates left standing? Is there anybody who a freedom-loving individual could support? I'm not going to announce supporting anybody, partially because I don't actually think there is anybody, but also partially because, as you know, I run a 501c3, and I can't endorse a candidate even if I wanted to. Luckily, that gives me an out because I don't really want to endorse anybody. So that's cool. All right, so I want to try to understand the 2016 election and what it says about the American people, what it says about the stage in history that we're in right now, what it says about what Ayn Rand wrote many times about the American sense of life. That. So what do we mean by sense of life? Ayn Rand, this is the expression of deeply held beliefs that Americans have, kind of metaphysical beliefs about the world that is expressed in their attitude, expressed in what gets them emotionally excited. And Ayn Rand always believed that the American sense of life was pro-individualism. The American sense of life was pro-capitalist. The American sense of life was pro the principles of the founding of this country. And there's always a question, even though she would say, and she argued, that wasn't expressed necessarily in their explicit ideas and in the way they voted and in the positions they took on any particular issue. But in times of crisis, in times of, you know, in times of crisis or when the contrast was really stark, like in 1972, you know, when McGovern was running and he was clearly this radical leftist, the American people, not because they understood that his ideas were bad, not because they understood the source of why his ideas were bad, but they rebelled against that and you know, voted for Nixon. If you remember, Ayn Rand was, you know, anti-Nixon, who was going to vote for Nixon. I mean, that was kind of the idea that the vote for Nixon was a vote against McGovern. It wasn't a vote for Nixon. But she argued that the American sense of life, at least, that emotional, that automatic response, was still anti-collectivistic, anti-socialist, anti collectivism. That's the core of it. And that would get aroused at times of crisis. And the question has always been, and she always acknowledged, look, but the sense of life is eroding because the sense of life is a consequence of fundamental ideas. And as the fundamental ideas in the culture change, get worse, get more collectivistic, more altruistic, more socialistic, more statist, the emotion, the sense of life will not withstand that assault. And slowly, you know, because I believe that, Ayn Rand believed, that emotions were consequence of ideas, consequence of decisions and conclusions that you have come to at some point in life. and that they were not independent of the ideas that you held. So that most Americans hold conflicting ideas. Most Americans hold conflicting ideas. And therefore, they have conflicting emotions. But that there is a core set of ideas, and actually some fundamental ideas, which they have adopted in a sense from the founders. They have adopted through tradition, if you will, from what it means to be an American, what America actually stood for once. And that is the emotion that leads to this sense of life. Those are the ideas that lead to this American sense of individualism, of I can get it done, we can be successful, I can be successful. You know, it's what prevents Americans from being as envious as Europeans are, resentful of success and wealth as Europeans are, at least has in the past. But that fundamentally, we are shaped by ideas. So as we abandon those good ideas, that sense of life gets eroded, or as those good ideas get more wishy-washy, as the foundation for those good ideas gets looser, gets less strong, the sense of life will slowly dissipate. And Leonard Peikoff, and I can't remember, I think this was 2003 or 2004, gave a talk called Americans versus America. And I highly, highly recommend that you listen to that talk. It's on, you can get it at the Ayn Rand bookstore. And he gave that talk at Fort Hall Forum. And I think it might also be on YouTube, but I'm not sure. But it's certainly on the Ayn Rand bookstore. And in that talk, he said, this is right after 9/11. He said, given the response to 9/11, given this disaster that's happened, the American sense of life did not kick in. And that Americans' sense of life has been diminished substantially. Yeah, you can actually see this video that was recorded April 21st, 2003 at Fort Hall Forum. You can catch it on YouTube. I highly, highly recommend it. Americans versus America. And his argument is Americans don't have the sense of life anymore. If they had, they would have responded very differently to 9/11. And we could do a different show on how Americans should have responded to 9/11. But the point is that has eroded. It is gone or eroded significantly. And whether there was any hope for it or not was a question mark, a big question mark. And that's why it's Americans that actually people who live in America today versus America. America in the sense of what America represents, what America is about, the idea of individualism, the idea of reason as man's guide, those ideas, but primarily represented by individualism and ultimately capitalism, those ideas that are at the core of America, Americans have rejected, and their sense of life is no longer consistent with America. And so, again, the question is, where are we today? Where's the American sense of life today? What can we tell from the response of Bernie Sanders? What can we tell from the response to Donald Trump and to the rest of the Republican candidates and to Hillary Clinton? What can we tell about the American sense of life given this election? Now, I want to mention one more event that I think is very relevant to what we're talking about and maybe gives us a clues about the state of the American sense of life, the meaningfulness of this election, and everything else that's going on in kind of the American political life right now. And that is the rise, and one could argue the fall, of the Tea Party movement. Or the Tea Parties. I'm not even sure it was ever a movement, because it was never one body that was moving in a pre-specified direction. It was a very fragmented, lots of different groups with lots of different agendas. Not a movement, qua movement, with no really coherent set of ideas that would guide a movement. So, the Tea Party came, you know, really arose as a political phenomena and was huge in 2009 with the bailouts, with the Obama election, with the stimulus. There was a rebellion among many Americans, they marched out into the street. And I was there in 2009, actually spoke at this event when there were well over 500,000 people, maybe more than that. Some, by some estimates, up to 2 million people in Washington, D.C., in the mall, party moment. And it was truly unbelievable. And there was really the sense that the American sense of life was back and that these people were rebelling based on the American sense of life. And they had had it, and they were fed up, and they had had it with statism, because that was their complaint, right? Government is too big. Government regulates too much. Taxes are too high. Get government off our backs. Don't tread on me. All symbols of statism. Enough. We've had enough statism. We want to go back to the Constitution. They talked about the Constitution. They talked about the Declaration of Independence. And they were, and Atlas Shrugged. They were, they brought out Atlas Shrugged, and Atlas Shrugged was big, and they claimed, at least some of them, right, claimed allegiance to the ideas of individualism, to the ideas of capitalism. Again, up to a point, but it was an exciting moment. There was a real sense in 2009 of hope, of that the Tea Party rise would really be an opportunity to change, to shift America. I mean, I was hopeful. Many people in our camp were hopeful. And we went out there and engaged with the Tea Party and talked to the Tea Party and wrote for the Tea Party. I mean, Free Market Revolution, my first book, which you should all have, and you have no excuses there because it's on every format known to man, and it's available for download immediately, instantaneously on Nook and Kindle and everything else, iBook. So you should go now and get it. Free Market Revolution, How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. That book was written for the Tea Party, and indeed it was a bestseller when it came out. It sold a lot of copies, and many of those copies went. There was a real sense of hope. There's a real sense of these people are open to new ideas. And unfortunately, what the last, certainly this election has proved, has shown, is that that was a lost hope. That was a false hope. The Tea Party, it turns out, I fear, and you're seeing this with the Trump candidacy, was far more interested in expressing their anger, in their emotion of frustration, than in any intellectual cause, any intellectual ideas. And yes, they would listen to a speech of mine and I would get a standing ovation at the end of it every single time. But it didn't sink in. It didn't sink in. They could not get the ideas. And a big part of that is the fact that the Tea Party was primarily a phenomena of older individuals, is primarily a phenomena of retired people. If you looked at an audience in a Tea Party gathering, it was mostly older. These are people who already have set ideas. They've already accepted the ideas of, to some extent or another, of American collectivism, certainly of altruism. And many, many, many of them, a vast majority of them, of religion and everything that has to do with. And their altruism and collectivism prevented them, for example, from arguing that in the attempt to shrink government, which is a cause they claim to really believe in, that, for example, Medicare or Social Security should be challenged, maybe privatized, maybe done away with completely. They could never think of those things. They had grown up as a generation who accepted those programs as metaphysical, as their right, their entitlement. You couldn't question them. So while they were, in a sense of life sense, individualistic and pro-capitalist, they were ideologically the opposite. And they were too late to change, too old to change, too old to change. So yes, they all read Atlas Shrugged. Yes, they came to my lectures and they gave standing ovations. Yes, they stood out. They marched out into the street to argue against statism. But when the game came down to specific proposals, like what would you cut in the in government budget, they couldn't do it because altruism prevented them from being able to cut anything meaningful. So they love the spirit of Atlas Shrugged, and they have no idea what it actually says. They had no idea what the philosophy behind the book actually means. They were unwilling to have anything significant, anything fundamental challenged. So every candidate, even the candidates on their right, even the candidates who are Tea Party candidates, even the candidates they considered ultra-conservative, like Ted Cruz and to some extent Rubio, will not challenge the altruistic programs of Medicare and Social Security. Oh, no. Those programs must be left alone. And, of course, Trump wants to save them. He would never touch them. He would expand them. He would grow them, playing to this audience brilliantly. So what's happened to the Tea Party is it's, in a sense, disappeared. It's disappeared as a mass phenomena, disappeared as having an anti-statist agenda. I mean, there might still be people out there associated with the Tea Party who believe in limited government. But what's left is the anger. What's left is the frustration. What's left is the feeling of being betrayed because they've got an internal conflict. They believe in American values that are diminishing, that are disappearing, that are going away. And they have no idea, no idea how to solve it. They're right. They've been betrayed by every conservative who's ever run. They've been betrayed by the establishment. They've been betrayed by conservatives and the Republican establishment. They've been betrayed by everybody in politics. The country's moving in the wrong direction. They feel that. But they have no clue how to fix it. And when you tell them how to fix it, they reject it. They won't accept it. Because it's unacceptable for them. Their altruism, their collectivism, their ideas, their religiosity, and they're very religious. Their religiosity prevents them from accepting the actual solutions. So they're living a conflict. They're living frustration and anger and an understanding that America's deteriorating, that it's becoming statist and collectivist. But they cannot intellectually or emotionally accept the solution. They're torn. So, yes, yeah, some of them go for Ted Cruz because Ted Cruz tries to play everything. He tries to present himself as a constitutionalist, as someone going to go back to really believes in the founding and really understands individualism. And he also holds positions that are completely contradictory to that and that don't challenge this group. They don't quite buy it, even with Ted Cruz, because Ted Cruz is too provocative when it comes to ideas. He's too good in the good part of him, in the good part of him. He's too good. And I'm not talking about groups endorse which candidate. I'm talking about how individuals are voting. But so, you know, Ted Cruz is very religious, or at least he plays up religion in an attempt to get them. But Ted Cruz just comes across to them as just like every other conservative politician who's betrayed them. And this is the great appeal of Donald Trump. Donald Trump's an outsider. He's not a politician. And he's not trying to play them. He's not, you know, in a nutty way trying to overplay his religion. like Ted Cruz's. He's telling, and they don't agree with everything Donald Trump says. But what Donald Trump is doing is he's capitalizing on their anger, on the contradiction. He tells them, I'm going to make America great again. They want America to be great again. But they don't want to hear how you're going to do it. If you actually told them how to make America great, they would reject you. The beauty of Donald Trump is he doesn't actually have to tell them. And he plays on their fears. He plays on their false sense of patriotism. It's not your fault that America is not great. You didn't cause it not to be great. It's the politicians who did it. It's the Chinese who are to blame. It's the Mexicans who are to blame. It's not you. You're great. And there was a fabulous op-ed. There was a fabulous op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this last week by Holman Jenkins, my favorite op-ed writer, just stylistically and the clarity of his thinking. He's just excellent. And he wrote, you know, this Tea Party, right? In the Tea Party, they on the one hand had these signs of, you know, we're fed up with big government. We want to go back to Constitution. We want all this stuff. And then they'd have signs about Atlas Shrugged and John Galt and everything. Then they would have signs saying, keep your hands off of my Medicare. They want to have their cake and eat it. They want to have their statism and object to it. They want to have their individualism and be collectivists. And that's exactly what Donald Trump is appealing to. He's appealing to that contradiction. He's appealing to the wanting the cake and eat it too, and he's telling them you can have it because it was never your fault. You see, it's not America's fault that America's not great again. It's these politicians who've negotiated these bad deals. That's the problem. It's not you. It's not the contradiction in you. Now, my analysis of why America's not great, right, is the contradiction in the people. You are at fault. The Tea Party is at fault for wanting their Medicare and wanting to shrink government at the same time. That's impossible. That's impossible. It's your fault, America. Now, that's a message Americans don't want to hear. That's a message they don't want to hear. What they want to hear is it's not our fault. We're the good guys. We're patriotic. And in that sense, they become completely collectivist, the Republican Party, and falsely patriotic. Remember McCain's slogan when he ran? The reason I didn't vote for him? His slogan was country first. And people loved that slogan on the right. People loved it. But that's the kind of collectivism. That's the kind of false patriotism that the right and the Tea Party has, and that is creating this contradiction. It's not country first. It's the individual first. The individual is the standard. We measure everything by its impact on the individual, not on the country. The only way to make America great is to make it individualist. And the only way to make it individualistic is to shrink, philosophically, we'll put aside philosophically, education, in the ideas of objectivism, but put that aside. The only way to make America great again is to shrink government, eliminate violations of individual rights. And that includes eliminate, phase out, do away with Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, welfare state, and on and on and on we go. All the things that Donald Trump says he won't touch, all the things that Americans don't want him to touch, don't want Americans to touch. Again, they want their cake and to eat it too. And the only way to explain America's decline without blaming it on Americans, the only way to explain Americans' decline without explaining that all these government programs have caused America's decline is to blame it on somebody else. And that's what Donald Trump is doing brilliantly, brilliantly. So he's hooking into nationalism. He's hooking up to, we want Atlas Shrugged and Medicare at the same time. He's hooking into the sense of all these Americans that it's not their fault. And there's one other thing he's hooking into. And this is important because this is legitimate. What really is the cause of America's decline? Who is, if we had to point a finger at somebody, who would we point the finger at? Who is to blame for America's decline? Why is America in decline? It's not the Chinese. It's not the Mexicans. Arguably, it's not even our politicians. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about who we should blame for the decline and how Donald Trump is reflecting that, and American people are indeed responding. We'll be right back after these messages.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org. Today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind? A hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades? The need to prove superiority? Or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Rourke, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Rourke, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
You might have recognized the voice in that last ad of Mark Pellegrino's, who graciously agreed to tape some of these ads. I think has raised the quality of our advertising significantly. All right, so who's responsible? Who's responsible for the state of America? Who's responsible for the frustration that so many Americans feel? It's our intellectual elites. It's our thinkers. It's our writers. It's our speakers. It's our teachers. It's our educators. It's our professors. And Donald Trump mocks them. He's the anti-intellectual. He really is the most anti-intellectual candidate we have ever seen in America. There's never been a more vulgar, more, if you will, down to earth, but not in a positive sense, unintellectual person in the history of America in terms of running for president and succeeding. He is standing up against the intellectual elites, and I include in the intellectual elites the media, Hollywood, you know, people who went to the Ivy League schools and have learned the collectivism and the altruism and the statism from there, and are finding a variety of different ways to convey that to the American people, and ultimately are responsible through the political process for destroying this country. So it's include the political intellectual elites. And the American people are saying, yeah, we don't want those intellectuals. Those intellectuals have destroyed America. We don't want those politicians. Those politicians have destroyed America. And I sympathize. I sympathize. And everybody else is as part of that elite structure. Now, Trump went to good schools and Trump is well educated. But this is why his vulgarity plays so well. This is why he get away with saying the things that he does. Because the country doesn't want an intellectual. America doesn't want somebody who uses fancy words, because they relate fancy words to intellectuals who have destroyed this country. And they're right. And this is left and right. Now the left has explicitly, through its explicit ideas, destroyed this country. The right's responsibility for the destruction of this country is its adoption of the fundamental ideas of the left. And its unwillingness, and this is the key, the right has been unwilling to challenge the altruism, the collectivism that is being inculcated in America by the left. And that is the great sin of the right. And, you know, Trump gives off this false, but he still gives off this aura of an individualist, of, you know, somebody who thinks for himself, of somebody who loves America, of somebody who stands up to the bad guys, who stands up to the intellectual and political elites, even though he doesn't, even though all his ideas are just products of these elites, even though all his ideas are conventional, altruistic, collectivistic, and statist. He gives the aura, because of the way he speaks, because he snubs, because of the vulgarity, that he is different. But intellectually, he's not. He's actually worse. So if you take the anger of the Tea Party and you take the dominance of the left over the intellectual life of America, and you take the impotence of the right to challenge the left on anything fundamental, what you get is the 2016 elections. What you get is Bernie Sanders, who is a much more consistent applicant of the left's intellectual agenda than anybody else, doing quite well, better than anybody would have expected for a 72-year-old nobody, with very little charisma and nothing else, right? But attracting huge numbers of young people young people who are much more directly connected to the ideas the intellectual elite has been selling us. So that's one segment of the population. And you get an even bigger segment of the population that appears enamored by a bombastic, self-promoting, intellectually feeble, but angry and vulgar personality like Donald Trump. And at this point, they don't care about the Constitution because 90 plus percent of Americans don't know anything about the Constitution or don't really understand the Constitution and have been taught wrong things about the Constitution, not just by the leftist elites, but by the right-wing elites. You know, the veneration of Justice Scalia by the right is a good example of that. Justice Scalia, who did not believe in individual rights, is venerated by the right. So how can the people, how can the Tea Party people believe in individual rights when this great conservative scholar doesn't? They've been betrayed by the intellectuals on the left. By the right, sorry. They've been betrayed by the intellectuals of the right. And they seem like they want to reject the intellectuals on the left. And the overall theme of this election is the rejection of the intellectual elites. Right and left. Conservative, moderate, middle of the road, or leftist. What the electorate is doing is rejecting intellectuals. Rejecting intellectual arguments. This is why, and the other candidates seem to get this. This is why what you get in the debates now is not an argument about issues, not a debate, but who can insult whom the fastest, because it's all about emotion. The electorate doesn't want an intellectual argument. Indeed, they rejected the very idea of an intellectual argument. The whole rebellion of this election is a rebellion against intellectual arguments. And of course, at the core of that, and I blame the intellectuals, now let's blame the American people. At the core of that is two things, faith and altruism. And of course, they're tied together quite closely. Americans are way too religious to be individualists, way too religious to be capitalists. And as a consequence of their religion, religion here being left and right, they are way too faith-based to be anything but altruists. So if you take faith and if you take altruism and you combine them, all that they're left with is emotion. And all that they're left with, which is good, is their sense of life, and that's diminishing and being diminished dramatically, again, by the ideas. Now, I'm just going to remind you, because I know a lot of people who listen to the show are not necessarily that familiar with objectivism. By altruism, I don't mean by being nice to people. I don't mean, you know, being benevolent. I'm a big believer in benevolence and being nice to people, not all people, you know, but in principle, being nice to people. Altruism is the ideology that says that the moral purpose of your life is to serve others. The moral purpose of your life is the well-being of other people. And that the noblest thing you can do is sacrifice your life to them. Now, while nobody actually acts on those principles, not consistently, you would die if you did. It is the animating factor behind every single bad policy we have today. And it is the animating factor behind the fact that you cannot challenge Medicare. What about the poor? You know, that is, I've said this in the past on the show, the first question I get at every lecture I give, no matter what the topic is and no matter what the composition of the audience is, but what about the poor? And I'm tempted, and once in a while I do this, and ask, why do you care? But everybody would view that as a horrific question. Why do you care? Why is that the first thing that comes to your mind? Because we've been trained to do it. We've been trained to feel guilty for success, to feel guilty for being good, for being guilty for taking care of our own lives, to feel guilty for the elements in our lives where we are self-interested. And as a consequence, we reserve all policy decisions in this bucket of, but what about the poor? So yeah, I'm actually not going to live a life like Mother Teresa, but I know I should live a life like Mother Teresa. So when I vote, I'm going to vote for policies that I think Mother Teresa would support. And that's how you get the welfare state, and you get Medicaid, and you get Social Security. And that's how you can't get rid of them. Because what about the poor if you get rid of them? What about them? And the Republicans say, oh, we care about the poor too. And the response to that is, we care about the poor, so therefore free markets are better for the poor. Forget it. You've given up. You've lost already. And I say, I care about the individual. Some individuals are poor, some individuals are not. But I care about an individual, and I want policies that maximize the freedom and liberty of that individual. I care about the individual, and therefore I want to maximize the opportunities of that individual. Whether they take advantage of them or not is their problem. And if they don't take advantage of the opportunities, and as a consequence they're poor, I don't care about them. I don't care about them. That's the kind of non-PC talk a real individualist would engage in. That's the kind of non-PC talk that real non-PC candidate would talk. And that's why, you know, nobody does it. Because nobody would vote for them. Nobody would vote for them. Of course, all the candidates are bought into altruism anyway. And if you're an altruist, and if your standard philosophically is the well-being of other people, even if you support capitalism because it helps other people, even if you support capitalism because its primary virtue is it helps the poor, you've lost. You've lost. The American Enterprise Institute with Arthur Brooks, all of these conservatives, all of them, Marco Rubio makes a big deal about helping the poor. They've lost, and they will continue to lose. And when they get into power and they become president, they will never enact the right policies. We will never get capitalism because it helps the poor. Never, ever, ever will we actually get capitalism by arguing that it's good because it helps the poor. It's good because it helps the individual. And what we need to argue is what matters is not the poor or the middle class or the rich. What matters is the individual and his freedom. That's what the founders cared about. And that's why they won. They lived in a culture. They respected the individual. I can't even talk now. They lived during the Enlightenment, during the age of reason, or the age of individualism. We live in very much an age that has turned against reason, and therefore turned against individualism. And where altruism is raised as the standard by both the religious right, the moderate right, and all forms of the left. And that's why there's no real advocate for freedom and for liberty up on stage in the Republican or Democratic debates. None. Because they've all accepted altruism. And once you accept altruism, you cannot be an advocate for freedom. Not consistently. Not consistently. And of course, Donald Trump is the worst of all of them in that sense. Altruism has to be collectivism, because if other people are the standard, then other people are the standard, which means them, the group, that group. And then it becomes my group against your group. And that's what Donald Trump, again, is taking advantage of. It's the real collectivism that exists in our culture today. It's America versus Mexico. It's Americans versus Chinese. It's Americans versus its intellectuals. Now, that one's true. But it's the group that matters, not the individual. It's not about individual rights. It's not about individual freedom. It's about fear, emotion, sacrifice, my group versus your group. And note that Donald Trump takes advantage of all these, all the negative phenomena that exist in American culture today. Trump has hooked into them brilliantly, And, you know, that's why he's winning. That's why he's being successful. You know, we can hope he doesn't continue to win, but that's why he's being successful. All right. So I've been talking now for 45 minutes straight. Let's see if you guys have any comments, suggestions on this topic or other topics. And at some point here, we'll open it up to a general Q&A. I have some questions from last time that that I would like to address. You know, by the way, the Republican establishment hates Trump, not because you know, he's too progressive or he's too left wing for them, or because he's an outsider. No, they hate Trump because he's unmasked them, and that's the one virtue he's done. He's what he's revealed is the real split between the political intellectual elites and the American people. He's unmasked the real frustration and anger that is there under the surface. The Republican elites who have been betraying people for, you know, since the Great Depression, at least, since the Hoover administration, really, the Republican elites do not want to acknowledge that betrayal. So what Trump is forcing them to do is reflect on that. Is confront that, is confront that the American people actually hate them. And that's what pisses them off more than anything else. And that's why I think they end up rally around Cruz or anybody to try to defeat anybody, to try to defeat Trump. Because Trump is showing them, you know, that the king has no clothes. He really showing them to be completely naked, showing them to be the enemy. And they are the enemy. The RNC, the establishment Republicans, they're part of the problem. They've sold the American people a bunch of lies for a long, long time. And the American people are fed up. They're fed up. And that's the one thing Trump has done. He's revealed that. And they don't want that. They don't want that. All right. We are going to take some questions. I see nobody wants to call in with a question. As I said, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. I have some questions that are coming in on Twitter, and I've got some questions that are leftovers from last time that I'm going to get to. When I get back, we are going to talk about immigration a little bit, right? Immigration. We're going to talk about immigration in the U.S. a little bit, some questions around that. We're going to talk about European migration and rape. I've been challenged to talk about the rape, so-called rape crisis that's occurring in Europe, so we will do that. You know, more on immigration. Immigration is the one topic people really want to talk about. I also want to talk about, if we have time today, if not, we can leave it for a future show, to talk about abortion in the context of the Zika virus. Because, to me, the Zika virus is making the anti-abortion argument so much more horrific than ever before. The idea that a woman at 3 months, knowing that if she gives birth, the baby is going to have a deformed and no or a brain that can never function properly, and that she is forced to carry to term with that knowledge and give birth and raise that child. Oh my God, that just reveals the true evil of the anti-abortion position. And I'm purposely saying, you can tell this at 3 months now, and yet they're not allowing it. You know, certainly, but at any point, if you could tell that, think of what that involves. Think of what you're turning the woman into and the family unit into by having to take care of that. Okay, that is what Ayn Rand really called living death. it's a life destroying thing forced upon the woman by the state. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back. We've got one phone call, and then I'm going to take some questions from
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, why should we care? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn. And the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
So just to summarize before we take, we've got one call in, I've got some other questions. The Tea Party movement was much more anti-intellectual than I believed at the time it was. I was far too optimistic about the Tea Parties. It was far more religious than I thought it was, far more altruistic than I thought it was. But importantly, it was far more anti-intellectual than I thought it was. And as a consequence, they couldn't learn. And they had these embedded contradictions, and they couldn't intellectually get out of those contradictions. And what you're seeing today is basically many of those people in the Tea Party, in a sense the worst of the Tea Party, going for Donald Trump. Now, I'm going to take one call. Let's take a call, and then I've got some written questions related to this particular topic. But hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Harold. How are you doing?
Hi, Harold. How are you?
Good. Hey, just very briefly, last week you mentioned how your experience as an individual versus a collective, you mentioned how living in Israel was an experience in a big unruly family where people didn't respect your boundaries and your privacy and just butted in whenever. It turns out there was a movie from 1994 based on a book from 92 called Etz HaDomim Tafus. It's basically a children's home just after early 1950s. And refugees would come in from Europe. And they were all groupthink, group action, except for one girl. She would always take personal initiative. Whenever anything needed doing, she'd do it herself right away. And needless to say, she was not very popular. You know, I nicknamed her the capitalist.
Yep.
And at one point, she's talking to a friend of hers, and she says, I want to have my own place. I want to wake up alone. I want to go to sleep alone. I can't stand all this togetherness. Alone, do you hear me? Alone. And that was like the punchline. That was the funniest line from the movie.
That's great. And what was the name of the movie again?
Etz HaDomim Tafus. There was a tree at the top of a hill. And when people wanted privacy, they'd go sit under the tree. And the tree was visible from everywhere. And so if they saw someone sitting under the tree, then they wouldn't go up there. That was their moment. Okay. That was their only time to have privacy.
I'm going to look for that movie because that's pretty cool.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you.
I have enough opinions on politics all week long, so I'm done with politics for now.
Good.
Okay, see you. Bye.
Thanks for the recommendation. All right, we got one more call. Noah, is this Noah?
Yep.
Oh, hi, Noah. So when you dial in, you have to press 1 for me to know that you want to ask a question, and not just listen on the phone.
Oh.
So that's why I didn't notice you on hold there. And generally, for all of you, if you're online right now and on hold, but you want to ask a question, then press 1, and that way I'll know that you're on the queue. What's up, Noah?
Great. Well, first I just want to say I love your book, and I agree with a lot of what you say, but I just wanted to come out in a defense of Trump a little bit. I wanted to mention a mechanism just to add to what something else at play that might be going on as to why people are believing what they believe. So I think our free market ideas are at a disadvantage. If you bring up the minimum wage to anybody, you're looked at like a villain. And politicians in general, when they bring this up, they get attacked. And as soon as they get attacked, they back down. They back down. And this backing down is out of fear, partly out of fear, and I guess they don't believe it. Many different reasons, but whatever. The public sees this and they say, well, if he doesn't believe it, it must be a crazy idea. And then the media doesn't help. You know, they all pile on. And so that's why I think the first time Trump showed everybody a blueprint. Now, I don't agree with the stuff that he was saying that people were freaking out about.
No,
not all of it. Some of it I did.
But what's the blueprint? Not backing down?
Because people were – I couldn't believe it in the face of everybody saying this is going to be his demise. And I think it's very important because people were thinking this is the end of him. And it showed people, politicians, look, we can fight for our ideas and it's not going to be the end of our careers. Look, this guy, now he has an advantage. He has a history. He's on celebrity. He's very good.
He's
got an advantage. But still, I think that's the blueprint. You can't back down. And if you do lose your career, at least you tried, you fought for your ideas.
No, I agree with that completely. But let me challenge this about Trump, because he flip-flops all the time and nobody pays attention. That's the thing. So, for example, and I just read this today. Yesterday, he changed his mind about one of the issues I actually agreed with him on, which was torture. And he's changed his mind on that. He's backed down. And he backed down during the debate. He took a position on H-1B visas. Right after debate, he flipped on it. He came out with a press release saying no. And yet it doesn't seem to impact. Nobody seems to care.
That's a good point. I never thought of that. But it could be, though, I don't get the impression he's backing down in the face of basically the backing down is this: oh my God, how can you believe this? And that's it. There's no argument. It's just that. I think I got the impression, at least from the backing down in Trump during the debate, that he got caught in a fact that he was wrong about. No, I don't agree with his beliefs, but
yeah, I get it.
So he didn't really back down out of he didn't back down out of, what do you call it, integrity or lack of integrity. I think he just
I don't think he has integrity, is my view. I think though what is true about this is that he is non-PC. He is ashamed of saying whatever he thinks, and so even if he changes his mind, he doesn't worry about changing his mind. And he's in their face, and he just says it. And I think people respect that. And I do think that's the best positive interpretation of what it is people see in Donald Trump, is he's not politically correct. And people admire that fact.
Right.
And you see, the other conservatives might be non-politically correct, but you're right. They're afraid to actually say it, and therefore they get
none of them. Right. And just that one more thing on that thing about Trump being, I don't know, kind of insulting. And I hate to be like an old person who attacks the media and bringing up this whole thing, but I think it's a big deal because the media, for people who are not into politics but still vote, they get their facts second and third and fifth hand. And so they hear things and they believe it. And the media basically controls that knowledge. So when McCain calls Tea Party goers a hobbit or hobbits, which is very insulting.
Yep.
How is that? That's not even brought up. He's defend yourself, McCain. He's not attacked. Why not? Because he's attacking the right people. When Trump attacks him in retaliation, it becomes a deal. So the good deal about that is at least we found out about the insult that McCain made. But, I mean, so this is not just one example. This is every day.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And this is the one positive side. I just don't think – I think the negatives overwhelm that, and the idea, unfortunately, the anger is, I think, still the dominant aspect of what really is right.
One more positive. Don't you get the impression, though, with all the negatives Trump has, I get the impression he loves America. He's American. He's an American phenomenon. Compared to Hillary and Obama, I don't know which one of the two is hates America more. It's hard to tell. But at least Trump is the opposite of that. No matter his ideas might be wrong, he might be muddled, he might not know what he's doing. But at least
I don't know if that's true. I don't know if I agree with you. I don't get a sense that he loves America, because I don't get a sense that he knows what America is. And he I think this will make America great again. Yeah, I mean, he likes his life and he likes the people around him. But there's no sense of what is America, right? To me, America means something. It has a deep meaning. And, it means the Declaration. It means individual rights. It means, I hope what it meant to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, what they were willing to risk their lives for. Donald Trump has no clue of any of that, is my sense. He has no respect for the Constitution, no respect for what America really stands for. He'll walk all over anybody to get his way. And he's done this in his career. He uses eminent domain. In a disgusting way, he sues anybody who says anything negative about him, ignoring any issues of free speech. He does not have that respect for what America really is. You have to know something in order to love it, is I guess my point.
Well,
and
I think that he knows it a little bit on the subconscious level without being an intellectual about it, but it's diametrically opposed to. And I hate to give Clinton credit,
but she knows it. He loves something. He loves something, but he doesn't love America. He loves a system that leaves him alone to do deals. But if somebody gets in the middle of those deals, he'll want the government to go take them out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can't argue with that.
All right. Great. Thanks for calling. I really appreciate it. And call again, but next time press the 1 so I know you're there. All right. We've got a bunch of callers on now. Thanks, Noah. And let's go to, let's see, who's this? You're on the Iran Brook Show. Hello? Oh, it's not connecting.
This is Ari. Can you hear me?
Hey, Ari. Yep, I got you. Go ahead, Ari.
Okay, so I'm from Colorado. I generally agree with what you're saying.
The Ari, okay.
But I wonder if you, if there might be more room for optimism than you're making out. And so here's my basic argument. A lot of cultural shifts are just not reflected in popular headlines and in what people are talking about on a day-to-day basis. So, for example, Trump is sort of a unique, strong personality, combination of a rich businessman plus a TV star. And so if there, without that unique combination, there just wouldn't be a Trump phenomenon. And so a lot of people who read your book, Free Market Revolution, I think maybe took more of that to heart than you think, but their views just aren't being represented in the popular debate. So I actually led a book club review going through your book, and I okay. think with that kind of discussion, it really did shift people's views, not all the way, and maybe took them a couple or three extra steps toward your conclusions. And some people were more persuaded than others. But I have the sense that there are quite a few people out there who have been shifting more toward individualism and capitalism, but there's just nothing out there right now to represent them.
Yeah,
Trump
doesn't. Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying, and this is why, and I think we agree on this. This is why the intellectuals in a culture are so important, because it's not that the American people are unconvincible. It's that to convince them requires getting them to read a book or to do a book club or to actively engage in an educational, you know, interaction. And that takes time and it takes effort. And it would take to really get that going, it would take the efforts of a large group of intellectuals. And this is why I think the work you do, Ari, and the work the Ayn Rand Institute does and others do out there is so crucial, because we're trying to do that, but we're tiny. Right. But if there were a thousand of us, right, I think this country can be saved. My worry is there are not enough of us, not enough people reading the book. I think if they read the book, if they listen to a lecture, if they engage, we can move them, particularly if they engage more than once. That is, listen to a lecture and another lecture and another lecture and read a book. Yes, people's ideas can be changed. But because most intellectuals are so bad, most people have disengaged or rebelling against the intellectuals, and they therefore never have the opportunity to do that. And then they're stuck with this emotional contradiction that they're living under. And I think what Trump is doing is revealing that. That is, he's taking advantage of that. He's the manifestation of that. Now, it's also true that he would not be as successful as he is today if not for the fact that he is a celebrity, that he came in as a celebrity. But then what would we have? Then we would have just the mishmash of an uninteresting. We'd have the 2008 and 2012 elections, which were boring, uninteresting, and ultimately it's a candidate that nobody could get excited about on the right. And I think we would have had the same thing in this election. And, you know, Trump has at least forced kind of the candidates to try to be more interesting. But you know, I have to be optimistic, like, as you indicated, that there is, that you can convince people, because that's my job. That's what I do. And I think I do change people's minds. I know that. And I know you do. And I know others do. And the fact is that we change people's minds in the thousands, and Donald Trump attracts millions. And until we can scale to where we're changing people's minds in the millions, we're losing. So So even though we're growing, we're still losing, and I think we are growing. I think the case for individualism, the case for liberty, the case for even for objectivism as a full-fledged philosophy is growing. The more people engaged, the more people interested, the more people – but the other side is just so much bigger, and the country continues to deteriorate, and the number of bad intellectuals is so dominant that – I sometimes wonder whether we are growing fast enough to win. I certainly hope so, but it's easy to be pessimistic given the state of the world.
Well, my baby boy is about 7 months old, so I'm really trying hard to hold to the case for optimism, because it's
absolutely
really important to me more now than ever.
I'd say one of the great values of having children is it forces you to orient yourself towards the positive, because you can't, and it's wrong for the children. You shouldn't have children. If you're overwhelmingly dominantly pessimistic, it's irrational to have children. So and if you have children, once you have them, you have to orient yourself to being, to finding the good values. And they are, they're great values. And there is hope because we are making progress. It's just a question of, are we making progress fast enough? And that just means we have to fight harder and we have to do more and we have to get the word out even further because we have kids and because we want to make our anybody who has kids, his horizon goes from his lifetime to two lifetimes, which means it's much longer, which gives us more time for change, which in and of itself should be a sign, you know, an opportunity to be somewhat optimistic. But congratulations on the baby, Ari. I don't think I've seen you since you had the baby. And yeah, keep up the good work and keep being positive because we need it.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ari. All right. Hi, you're new on Brooke Show. Who's this? Hello?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hey, Ron. It's Paul in Connecticut. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I'm doing well.
Good.
I'm calling about Trump recently took a lot of heat for saying that you should bomb the families of the terrorists. And people were even throwing around the term of war crime. And it made me think,
yep.
Like, what would you have to do on an international level? Well, first of all, is that kind of a policy appropriate, which I would imagine I think you would think it is. But if it is, then what would you have to do on an international level to be able to carry that out if you deemed it a legitimate strategy?
Well, I would never phrase it as what you need to do is bomb the homes of the terrorists because, I mean, the terrorists could be, I mean, a lot of the terrorists are from the West, right? And their parents came here and they immigrated here and they're trying to integrate. So family is way too general, right? You're not going to penalize the family because it's the family. What
right.
you need to do is bomb the people who agree with the terrorists. What you want to do is bomb the people who support the terrorists. So
right.
the very idea that Donald Trump would phrase it as we're going to go out and bomb the families of the terrorists, it's just a stupid way of phrasing it, which is very indicative to the fact that he talks before he thinks. But I do support him on what he said about torture. Actually, he's retracted all that now, but I support that. And so what do you do about international conventions? I would get out of the international conventions. Look, the bad guys don't sign those conventions. It's not like the Nazis said, ooh, we signed the now I'm blanking on the name of the treaty that governs torture and these kind of things. Anyway, I've forgotten. Anyway, it's not like the Nazis says we signed these so we're going to behave ourselves. And oh, the Americans are not signatories, so we're not going to behave ourselves. No, the bad guys do whatever bad guys do. They torture, they maim, they slaughter, they do whatever they have to do. The only thing that these treaties do is constrain the it's a Geneva Convention. Sorry. The only thing the Geneva Convention does is restrain the good guys. So I'd say get out of the Geneva Convention and say, look, we're the good guys, and we're going to defend ourselves, and we're going to do whatever is necessary to defend ourselves. We will never kill gratuitously. We will
right. yeah,
only
yeah.
kill when the aim is victory. We don't kill as retribution. We only kill to protect the rights of our own citizens. And we don't
exactly,
torture
yeah.
gratuitously. We don't torture for the fun of it. We torture only when it is a necessary, not optional, but necessary step in protecting the individual rights of Americans. That's it. That's all you have to say. And then act on it. And then the world would be a very peaceful place very quickly if America actually acted on it. And you wouldn't have to act on it.
People will argue with you about that, and they'll say, like, you know, what happens when Russia gets mad at you for that or something, you know, like if you attack a bunch of people and they don't like it, and now all of a sudden they've got nukes or something. And it gets
it's a false argument, and because what are they going to do? Is Russia going to go to war with America over Syria? No. Is Russia suicidal? No. Is Russia going to be pissed off and sanctions or whatever? Who cares, right? Are the Europeans. Now, the Europeans are more important.
Anyway.
The Europeans would get angry, right? Because it would,
yep.
and they'd be really upset, and they'd call. But they're upset at us anyway. They don't like us anyway. And if they had trade embargo, anything like that in the United States, they would suffer far more than we would suffer. America
and
has
to get them to like us. We have to let all the terrorists come into our country.
Yes, we have to kill Americans so they like us. I mean, that's
right.
absurd. Okay.
Exactly.
Yep. So you have to say, if you, but the opposite is actually true. You know, Ronald Reagan, when he said things like the Soviets are evil, the evil empire, the Europeans were horrified. Oh, how could you talk like that? But they all loved Ronald Reagan, you know, and nobody boycotted America. And he inspired the Polish resistance, and he inspired people in Eastern Europe to rebel against communism because he said those things, right? You didn't have to go to war. All he had to do was talk. And it made a huge, huge difference in the life of freedom fighters in Eastern Europe. Imagine if you had a president who talked and actually did. Most of the good people in the world would, their respect for America would increase dramatically. Most of all, in my view, in the Middle East. We'd become popular again in some countries in the Middle East, like Egypt, if we actually took a tougher stance. All right. Thanks for calling. Really appreciate
it. Thanks, Iman. Appreciate it.
Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this? There we go. Are you there?
Hey, this is Corey. Hey, Iran. Hey. This is Corey from Minnesota. How are you?
I thought you said you didn't have a question.
Actually, I do. I thought of something, so
okay,
I thought
good.
I'd give you a call.
Go
first
with
of
it.
All, though, I met a great group of people last Sunday, a Minnesota group of objectivists. It was first time meeting them, and it was fun.
I know. I've done talks for them, so it is there's a really good group of objectivists up in the Minneapolis area, and generally I like I've spent a lot of time in Minnesota and like it. Other than the fact that you guys have weather that's unlivable, but
well, yeah, that and the ISIS sympathizers could be a problem too. So that's a little bit disturbing. My question is: this seems like the type of year, a type of election year, where a third party person could come in and maybe sneak away with it. Do you get that sense at all? And if you do, who do you think would be an option?
I think there's a lot of talk about this, and I have no special knowledge about this, but what everybody is saying is that if it's Trump, Hillary, but certainly if it's Trump Sanders, then Bloomberg will run.
Former
mayor of New York. And Bloomberg would be a better option than both of them. He's not good. He's certainly no defender of individual rights. He's no capitalist. But he's not nuts like Trump is, and he's not as leftist as Hillary is. So actually, if Bloomberg ran, I would probably vote for him. So I think he is the candidate that's most talked about, that people are – he's got the money. He's much richer than Donald Trump. He's a proven politician. He did what looks like a decent job in New York. And he's got some real backing at the center of the political map. So I think Bloomberg would run.
That's interesting that you say he's richer than Trump. And I don't know, finances or whatever that
they
have. But
nothing I said here should suggest I'm endorsing Michael Bloomberg. He's awful on many things. I'm just saying if the selection is Clinton, Bloomberg, or Trump, I might go for Bloomberg.
Well, and he would just outlaw 16-ounce sodas and
he probably wouldn't eliminate free speech in America, which is I fear what Donald Trump would do. By the way, Bloomberg is worth something like $40 billion, but even that everybody says is an underestimation, because the company Bloomberg is I think private and nobody knows what it's really worth in the market. It's probably even worth, he might be the richest man in the world. Michael Bloomberg, he might be ultimately richer than Bill Gates even. All right, thanks for calling. Really appreciate it. Sure, I've only got 10 minutes, and I didn't get to all the questions I wanted to answer. So in a couple of weeks, I'm going to do another, I'll try to really dedicate a part of one of the future shows to answering some of these written questions that I got, because they're kind of getting old. But let me answer this quick one, because I keep getting challenged on this, and I'm gonna about the whole Muslim immigration and about immigration generally. I've got 10 minutes, and I want to end on a positive. This is gonna be rough. Look, so the idea is you got to vote for Trump, because he's the only one who will deport all the illegal immigrants, and the illegal immigrants become legal. then this country goes to hell anyway, and there's no constitution anyway, because they'll all vote Democratic and they'll empty the constitution of all content. A couple of things on that. One, Donald Trump will not kick out all illegal immigrants. Second, if he did, do you really want Gestapo-like stormtroopers going around neighborhoods, knocking on doors and checking your papers and kicking out the people who don't have the papers? And isn't that already such a violation of what it means to be free in this country that who cares who these people vote for? This country's finished already. Not to mention the fact that Donald Trump is the candidate of all candidates who is the least favorable towards free speech. And I will talk about this on my Chicago speech radio show talk that is coming up in an hour and will be posted on Blog Talk Radio in a couple of days. I'll talk about free speech and Donald Trump. And that's a huge violation of the Constitution and one you cannot come back from. Therefore, just based on that, you cannot support him. Third, nobody except for the left is arguing that illegal immigrants should be allowed to vote tomorrow. They should be allowed a path for legalization. I'm not arguing that. A path for legalizing their work status. How can you deny people who are working for a living the ability to work? It is not the job of the government to determine legal workers and illegal workers. Somebody's working. Somebody's paying him. There's a win-win transaction going on. He's legal. You got to separate the idea of working and being legal from citizenship. The two are not the same. It should be easy to come to America to work. It should be hard to become a citizen. Now, they say, if Muslims are allowed to immigrate into Europe and into America, they will dramatically change the culture. They bring their culture with them, and they will dramatically change their culture. Let me say that I don't believe that. If we had a culture that we believed in and were fighting for, the problem with cultural decay is not Muslims, and I'll get to the rape question in a minute. It's not Muslims. The problem of cultural decay in Europe and in the United States is multiculturalism. The enemy, the real enemy at the end of the day, are not Muslims. The real enemy is multiculturalism. But Muslims are all rapists. They hate women, and they rape women constantly. Now, look. I'm actually probably the only one out of all of you who's actually lived around Muslims, been to their homes, had, you know, friendly relationships with them. And that is just not true. Now, when you have multiculturalism and when you don't enforce the laws of your own land and when you invite anybody into your country, no matter what, whether they represent a risk to you or not, like Europe has done with this massive Muslim immigration, which, by the way, I'm against, given the scope of it and given that we're at war with radical Islam. You cannot allow 1 million last year Muslims to come into your countries. I'm against it. But it's not because of the cultural issue. It's because they're a physical threat. If we had a culture that we believed in, if we did not have multiculturalism, they would assimilate like everybody else is assimilated. If we didn't, one of the reasons I oppose bringing in refugees is I oppose bringing in refugees from anywhere. I don't believe the U.S. government should be paying for people to come here. You should have to pay your own way. But if you pay your own way and come here, and if you want to come here, we will assimilate you, baby. I believe in this culture. I believe in America. I believe in Americans. I believe in the ideas of this country. We will assimilate immigrants if we believe in those ideas. So the enemy is multiculturalism. The enemy is the university. It's not the immigrants. It's not the immigrants. Now, is rape increasing in Europe because of Muslim immigrants? It appears so. One of the stupid multiculturalist phenomena is that nobody is allowed to talk about it in Europe, so there are no accurate statistics that relate Muslim immigration to rape. But it appears that in some countries that have large numbers of immigrants from Muslim countries, rape has gone up. Now, there are many explanations for the rapes going up in Sweden, for example. The definition of rape is pretty wishy-washy. More women in Sweden than any other country in the world will actually report being raped or report being harassed than any place else. But what happened in Cologne when gangs of Muslims attacked women actually happened. And the fact that the police are not doing anything about this and the fact that it cannot be talked about, that is the real problem. But the police should shut this down. And by the way, the Cologne thing might have been an act of war, might have been an act of terrorism because it was so well coordinated because it was a number of different cities in Germany and involved thousands of men. But what about punishing them? What about actually enforcing the law? What about stating what our Western values are? Nobody does that. That is the best weapon against us. Now, 90% of the immigrants, the Muslim immigrants, into Germany and Sweden, probably 99%, don't rape anybody. And a certain high percentage of them are there because they're trying to make a better life for themselves. You can't ban everybody because there are a few rapists. You cannot ban everybody. All rapists are men, at least by some definition of rape. All rapists are men. Therefore, we should ban men from going outdoors after 6 p.m. because most rapes happen after 6 p.m. That's nuts. So more rapists are Muslim, so we won't have anything to do with any Muslim ever. That's nuts. That's nuts. Particularly Muslims who've chosen to come to the West. Now, again, I say we're in a state of war. We shouldn't be allowing Muslims into Europe and into the United States unless we can properly screen them for how radical they are. And since we cannot, don't let them in. I'm fine with that. But once the war is over, assuming we win, or if you could actually screen them properly, then I have no problem with Muslim immigration into the United States or into Europe that they fund, not that the United States government funds. And again, you have to get rid of welfare. You have to phase out welfare. You have to do a lot of things while you open up the borders. I'm not for, and let me be clear on this, and this will be, and then I'll say something positive, a positive value. I'm not for open borders tomorrow. I'm not for lowering everything. Just let them in. Write them welfare checks as they come in. That's ridiculous. That's what they do in Germany and Sweden. I'm for slowly phasing out restrictions on immigration, starting with people who actually can find a job, who actually are working, so they don't need welfare and they won't get welfare, and then starting to phase out welfare as you phase out restrictions on immigration. Right? So, all right. Let me switch gears, which is hard after that. Now, I know this raises a lot of still questions on immigration, and we'll have to go back to immigration on a future show to cover them. But let me do this quickly. Right? As I've said before, and I say this on many shows, one of, I think, the most valuable values in 2 minutes that I can embark on you is the whole area of classical music, which I think most people do not take seriously and do not engage in. And I think a life without aesthetics, a life without art is a life unlived to its fullest, unlived to its flourishing ability. And just movies, so because movies and television, there's some good stuff in it, but most of it is just not that impressive from a true aesthetic experience. By the way, at OCON this year, we're going to have a whole track on the value of art. So I encourage you all to come and participate. Everybody should come to OCON. Classical music is important here. So I encourage you to take music seriously and to listen to it. And the thing I'd like to recommend quickly are the romantic piano concertos. Brahms, both of his concertos, particularly number 2. Grieg, Schumann, Tchaikovsky's 3 piano concertos, particularly 1 and 2, Most people ignore number two. It's magnificent. Oh, it's so sweeping and beautiful and amazing. Rachmaninoff's four piano concertos, particularly two and three. Again, people ignore three. Oh, my God, some of the most beautiful music ever written. All right, so there you have it, positives. One more thing where I ask you to do something for me, actually for yourself, but also for me. Right now, if you haven't done this yet, go and buy a copy of Equal is Unfair. Help us make this a bestseller. Help us have an impact on this culture at an election year that is pathetic as this. We need good stuff out there. We need good intellectual material. The way to leverage me, the way to leverage our good intellectuals is for them to write books, but they're only going to write books if they sell. So you guys have to buy them, but you have to buy more than one copy because you have to give them to your relatives and to your friends. You buying them is just speaking to the choir, but you buying several copies and giving it to your leftist or rightist or Trump-loving or Bernie Sanders-loving, even better, friends and family, that is of incredible value. Now, the book will be available in every format known to man, as far as I can tell, including Audible. But I don't think you can pre-order Audible. I'm not sure. Audible will be out, I think, March 29th. But I can't sign an Audible, and I can't sign a Kindle. Another reason why you should get more than one copy, one hardback copy that I can sign, and then a Kindle to read it on, an Audible to listen to. Also, ari.aynrand.org/events. We got a bunch of great events coming up. Debates in Chicago, in San Francisco, in Seattle. I'll be in Portland, Oregon. We're going to be in Miami, in Southern Florida, generally. Certainly in New York City. We're going to have events in New York City. We're gonna be in Boston. Fort Hall Forum is going to have a debate. So check out ari.aynrand.org/events. Come to the events. We're going to have three different events in Chicago, one day after the other. And you can also get 25 copies of the book. And if you're interested in 25 copies of the book, tweet me or email me. You can email me at radio@icloud.com, and you can get a big discount on 25 or more of the book. And if you want to hold a party, like invite 20, 30, 100 people and have me come and speak, we can do that too. But again, send me an email, ariradio@icloud.com, ariradio. So, you know, let's get the book. Let's get the ideas out there for the world to have a chance. All right. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back next Saturday, 11:30 a.m., every Saturday, 11:30 a.m. Have a great week. This is the Aaron Brooks Show, signing off.